In this part of Focus 580, we're talking with historian James Tobin, and we'll be talking about a book that he has out just now that takes a look at some of America's greatest engineering achievements, things like the construction of the Hoover Dam, for example, the electrification of America, the building of the bridges in New York City. And the most recent project in this book is, well, there are two that are pretty recent. The Big Dig going on in Boston, probably the most ambitious highway project ever in the history of this country. And then the book finishes up with a chapter on the creation of the Internet. All of this is in the book that is titled Great Projects, The Epic Story of the Building of America, From the Taming of the Mississippi to the Invention of the Internet. It's published by the Free Press, has a lot of wonderful photographs and maps in it, and it is intended to be a companion to a series that will be airing on public television sometime next year. So that's something that you can look forward to and take a look at the book as a way of having a little bit of a preview. Just a little bit of information about our guest, James Tobin. He's the author of Ernie Pyle's War, America's Eyewitness to World War II, a book that won the National Book Critics Circle Award in Biography in 1998. That was the first full-length biography since 1950 of America's premier war correspondent. Right now, he's working on a book about the Wright family and the race for flight, and he's talking with us this morning by telephone. As we do that, of course, your questions and comments are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mr. Tobin, hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks very much, and thank you for talking with
us
today.
Thanks for having me.
How did you get involved in this project, this book project?
Well, I was working on this research for a book about the Wright brothers, and had learned that even though I have absolutely no background in technology, that that there's a great field of human creativity in the world of technology and engineering. And then, just heard through editor and agent friends that that this PBS TV series was going to appear, and that they were looking for a writer to turn this into a book for them. And so, so I signed on.
Mm. There's something about this that does really, when you look at these enormous engineering projects, it's not like nobody in the world has ever done things like this.
Right.
And yet there does seem to be something, they do seem to reflect something in the American psyche.
Well, I think so. You can't look at these projects and others in U.S. history and not come away with that conclusion. There's a tremendous sense of energy that gets channeled into building projects really from a very early time in American history. And when people talk now about the question of rebuilding the World Trade Center or something like it on that spot, I just think, well, that's just a foreground conclusion. That's just going to happen. I mean, it's just built into our national character.
Yeah, we cannot talk about everything that's in the book. So I thought maybe I might pick a couple of things,
sure.
and we could try to talk about them. And I guess I wanted to talk about the Hoover Dam, just because it's even looking at the pictures of it in the book and the project to building it, I'm just kind of awed by the idea of the size.
Yeah,
of this
it is.
Thing.
It's absolutely overwhelming. When I learned about the process of how it went up, all of the tasks involved, each one of them was a gigantic engineering project, and yet they were all put together to form this absolutely stupendous piece of concrete.
And nobody had ever built anything this big before?
No, that's correct. I suppose you could look at the Great Wall of China, even the Mississippi levees that I talk about in the first chapter. Possibly there's more material in those things, but as far as a single object, I think this was the biggest thing anybody had ever attempted.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that's notable about the project and other things like this is that probably without large-scale water projects like this, the West as we know it would simply not have been possible.
Right. There's no question about that. That this provides not only very important flood control in the Colorado Valley, but it provides electric power to a great deal of the region. Mm.
And how much of it, and the location of this, did also have to do with people who were interested in trying to develop Southern California?
Well, the original impetus came from an area that we don't usually think of in terms of the development of Southern California. That is, we usually think about, you know, Los Angeles, San Diego. The original impetus came out of the urge to develop what's now called the Imperial Valley, which is in sort of the southern central part of the state, right? It's east of Los Angeles. That is an area that got almost no rainfall, but is extremely fertile. And so right around the 1890s, 1900, some irrigation engineers saw the great potential in that area for irrigation, which would turn that into a terrific farming area. That eventually happened, but not before a number of disastrous attempts to irrigate the valley that turned into a terrible flood in 1905, 1906.
Yeah, that was, I think, what they simply did was they dug irrigation canals to divert the water from the river. But the problem was that it was like a sink with no drain. The water came in; it had no place else. It had no place to go.
That's correct. I mean, the water got out of control. They failed to put proper gates at the intake sections of these canals, and when the gates failed. It was at a time of torrential floods in the Colorado, and so the water got away from them and then flooded into this area called the Salton Sink, and really became known as the Salton Sea. It was this very large inland lake, as you say, with no outlet to the ocean. Mm,
that's a great piece of marketing that someone decided to take this area that was known as the Salton Sink and turn it into the Imperial Valley.
That's exactly right. That cracks me up. The developers put out these beautiful posters, you know, showing this land of agricultural bounty. And indeed, that is what it became. But at the time, it sure didn't look like any kind of a farming paradise. It was a desert.
Our guest this morning, just real quick to introduce again, is James Tobin. He's an historian. He's authored a book that's titled Great Projects, the epic story of the building of America from the taming of the Mississippi to the invention of the Internet. And one of the chapters deals with the subject we're talking about here this morning, that is the construction of the Hoover Dam on the Colorado River in Nevada. Your question is, of course, welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. We mentioned a moment or so, a little bit ago, that nobody had ever done anything like this. Five bids were submitted to the government. The low bid on this project was almost $49 million.
Right.
What would it cost today if you were going to build this? Do you have any idea?
I'm afraid I have not seen any estimate of that. It would be many times that amount.
It was one of the things that's still kind of stunning to me that's reproduced in the book is a check. There's a check here that was it's payment for a month's worth of work. It's a check from the Treasurer of the United States. It's typed out. And it's for $3.1 million. And I can't quite imagine the secretary, whoever rolled this thing into the typewriter and typed in there $3,129,482, you know, just typed it.
I had the same reaction when I saw that, when I first saw the facsimile of that check, and then it would be awfully nice to receive it. On the other hand, the engineers and the construction managers for six companies, the consortium that built it, they must have looked at that check and thought, well, I hope that covers our costs this month, because, of course, the costs of construction were enormous.
Mm-hmm. The one thing I think it's notable about all of the chapters in this book and all of the projects is that they really rely, not only did they rely on the efforts, the work of lots and lots of people, but there were individuals who were the driving forces behind these projects. And in this particular case, the man who was the chief engineer for Hoover Dam was a man named Frank Crowe. Tell us about him.
Well, Crowe is an interesting character. He had grown up in Maine, actually, was not a native Westerner, and then became involved in the Reclamation Bureau, which was the great dam-building agency of the Progressive period, and then on beyond that. Still exists, of course, but it was founded in the time of Theodore Roosevelt and was seen as a very progressive force. This was the bureau, the agency that was going to bring irrigation to the West, was going to extend sort of the domain of the family farm into these arid places. And Crowe was very inspired by that ideal and went to work soon after graduating from college in the West and spent the rest of his life there building dams. Not only Hoover Dam, but Shasta Dam and a number of the other great dams of the West. And 6 foot 6 inches tall, kind of a taciturn guy, extremely high energy. As I say, he worked around the West and had developed a loyal following of dam workers that followed him around. And guys flocked to work for him at the Hoover Dam site. Of course, this was in the midst of the Depression also, so it was a very attractive job offer that came from Crow. And just one of these figures that kind of looms larger than life. It's interesting, when the dam was finished, some reporter asked him, you know, how he felt now that it was all done, and his response was, "I feel lousy. I have to find another dam to build."
I'm just continually stunned by it. The idea that somebody would go to this place where they put the dam up and look at it and think, "I'm going to put a wedge of concrete in this spot." How would anybody even think, "Oh yeah, sure, you can do that"? The enormity of it seems just so much that you'd have to think somebody who would say, "Oh yeah, I can do that," would have to be a little touched.
I think you're right, and I must admit that capacity for imagination is quite beyond me. I think that great engineers do develop the ability to look at a site like that and simply see it in terms of the numbers. If we could build a smaller dam, why couldn't we magnify the numbers involved and simply build a bigger dam? It does take a certain quality of intellectual imagination to be able to have the chutzpah to think of a thing like that.
Yeah. Another part of this that's to me is equally amazing is that even before they could start to build the dam, they had to divert the river so they could have the dry bed. They couldn't build it if the river was there, so they had to get the river to go around the spot. And they carved through rock 4 tunnels, each of them as wide as the Lincoln Tunnel in New York City.
Right, and through, as you say, solid rock, and out in the middle of this almost uninhabited desert. The building of the diversion tunnels is really just as stunning a feat as the building of the dam itself. And they got it done with exceptional speed, too. Mm. Crow brought that in way ahead of deadline.
And they did this by building this thing that had a multi-deck kind of a deal on the front where they could put on, I think, 30 guys with drills.
That's right. Yeah, it's called a jumbo, the image that I used is that, you know, until this sort of project was undertaken, most work was done by men carrying machines, and they realized the people under Crow and the guys working for him realized that what they really need was a machine that would carry men, and so they rigged up this enormous, really a jerry-rigged outfit of just pipes and the back of a truck, a structure that they could roll in and out of these tunnels, and so that they could put 30 men up against the face of this tunnel at a time and drill and then blast. It had to be done quickly in order to make decent progress, and so these trucks would roll back into the tunnels. They'd do the drilling, the charges would be set, the trucks would race out again, and then the blasting would occur, and then they'd sweep out all the rubble and debris, and then they'd go back at it again.
Another one of the things that really complicated this, that made it just the whole task much more difficult, was that it's extremely hot there.
This is one of the hottest places in the United States, and so to be outside in the middle, right in the center of this canyon in summer was excruciatingly hot, and then to go into the tunnels, sometimes it could reach up to 120 degrees inside. So it really was just a hellish place to get this kind of labor done.
The dam is made of concrete.
Yes.
And to me, I guess, again, one of the really remarkable aspects of this is that they had to, first of all, they had to come up with a whole lot of it. But they had to make sure they had the materials to make it. They had to get it to the site. They had to make sure that the concrete didn't set before it got there. They also had to, had to think about the fact that if you didn't do it quite right, you know, it would take 100 years for the concrete to cure. So that wouldn't be very helpful. They didn't want it to crack. I mean, just the idea of pouring that much concrete and developing a system to do that in a timely way so that it also wouldn't take you forever to do it. That seems to be a pretty remarkable thing, too.
The thinking the whole thing out ahead of time is pretty extraordinary. And a lot of this was improvised right there for the first time on the site. It had never really been done that way before. And as I say, with the building of this jumbo inside the tunnels, there was sort of a similar structure or system that was set up in the canyon for moving this concrete and all the other supplies that they needed all over the place. A big circus trapeze by which they could run great big buckets around and dump them exactly where they were supposed to go. Sometimes they delivered to gangs of men that way. And so what you had was an enormous outdoor machine that moved everything that was necessary into its proper place at the proper time.
And how long did it take to build?
Well, let's see. The Reclamation Bureau took possession in 1936. It was done some months before that. And I guess they started, let me see, in 1931, I think, is the starting date. Yeah. And, they had various deadlines that they had to meet along the way. So 5 years.
So it's a remarkable story, and for people who are interested, you can read about it in this book that we've mentioned, Great Projects. It has a lot of has some interesting photographs, just so that you can get an idea about what was involved, some pictures of the people involved. It's all one of the chapters in this book, Great Projects, by our guest James Tobin. And we're going to continue to talk with James Tobin in just a moment. One thing I would like to pass on to you, a news item that our news director just handed me a couple of minutes ago, reported by the Associated Press, the continuing story of anthrax. President Bush says that a letter sent to Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle's office has tested positive for anthrax. The president says some of the office staff members were exposed to the bacteria. They are being treated. Bush says powder in the letter was field tested and is now being sent to a federal laboratory. That's what we have right now. This is Just Command. I'm sure there'll be more on this story later. If we find out more, we'll bring it to you, and you can expect throughout the day as part of our newscasts and as part of all things considered to hear more about the story. We want to take a second here to just a brief break in our conversation with James Tobin to just tell people who are listening how important their support is for this radio station. As we've said so many times over the years, other sources of funding have shrunk, and the only place that we can go to make that up, and I just dumped the caller. I pushed the bong button, Brian. Maybe somebody is going to have to call back I'm afraid I dumped Mr. Tobin. See, that's what happens when you try to concentrate on too many different things at once. Let me get back to my message here. The message is that...
Stay on message, David.
Stay on message. Over the years, other sources have shrunk. Only sources that have grown, it's the money from people like you. That's why it's so important that we get the support of everybody who listens to this station. Now's an opportunity for you to do it. A couple of times a year, we ask directly for support. This is one of those times. And by support, we mean money. That is it. 244-9455 is the number to call. Please do that right now. Jack Brighton, our producer, is here with me.
One of the things I love about working on the show, David, is we get to see these great books like this book, Great Projects, by our guest James Tobin. And it's a chance for us to explore ideas, history, and the world of thought out there. Just a whole variety of things that this show tackles over the days and weeks and months and years we've been doing it. And if this is the kind of program that you get something from, we hope you give something back to help us keep this going by calling with your pledge. It's something that we ask only every, maybe twice a year, we come to you on the air and ask you to call our pledge line. And we hope you'll do that right now. The number, area code 217-244-9455. Make your pledge call now. We have with us Maeve Riley, the editor of our Patterns magazine, which is another great thing that you get as a friend of WILL sent to you each month.
And I want to mention a couple of great projects here as well. You know, Hank Spies was here in the last hour, and he offered as an incentive to get people to call. If you call before noon, your name will be entered into a drawing to have Hank come to your house and check out anything you think that could become a great project in your house. And that's a great, really nice offer from Hank, who's a regular guest on David's show. And, you know, it just takes a minute of your time. If you make a pledge at the $40 level or above, you'll get Patterns, our monthly programming guide, and all kinds of information about WILL, AM, FM, and TV. But we need to hear from you. 217-244-9455. Hank's offer was just an extra incentive, and we know the regularly scheduled radio programs and the news that you get here on AM 580, that's another incentive. And, you know, we can't do that without you. So call now.
244-9455 is the number. Now, that's a different number from the one that we used to call into the show. And by the way, if you want to call into the show, that's welcome. No one will expect you to pledge. We'd think that would be really nice if you would, but it's not required to call in. This is a completely different thing. We have some volunteers, some really nice folks who are there to take the call. It will take a minute or two, and it's a great investment in the future programming of this station.
That's right. And we, just like you said, David, it takes a minute of your time. We have three volunteers sitting right here by the phone, and we'll can take a credit card, Visa, MasterCard, Discover American Express. It'll go right to work for the station, and it's just a great thing to do. So get your week started off right. Call 217-244-9455.
Okay. Thank you, Maeve. I want to get back to our guest for this hour of Focus 580, James Tobin. Again, let me tell you a couple things about him. He's the author of biography of Ernie Pyle, American war correspondent, titled Ernie Pyle's War, America's Eyewitness to World War II. It was published by the Free Press in 1997, and it won the 98 National Book Critics Circle Award in biography. He is also now working on a book about the Wright family and the race for flight. He's been a newspaper reporter. He worked for the Detroit News and was nominated twice for the Pulitzer Prize, and is talking with us this morning about this new book project that he's been involved in. It's titled Great Projects, and it is also published by the Free Press. And as we have mentioned, it talks about things like the building of Hoover Dam, the building of the bridges that connect Manhattan to the mainland United States, the building of the Internet, a number of different things in there. Quite an interesting book. This is a companion to a four-part series that also will be titled Great Projects that's expected to air on public television next year. So that's something that you can look forward to. And your questions are welcome if you want to call in. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Sorry, I disconnected you, Mr. Tobin, there.
No, not at all.
They're not going to put me in charge of any great projects.
Me neither.
One thing another thing I think is interesting is that as we kind of talked about earlier, that in any of these projects, there are individuals, really, in addition to the fact that there were huge numbers of working people that made this happen.
Right.
There were individuals that were the driving force. And what's of all of the people that you profile in here, I think it's striking, particularly of people from the past, that the only name that's really still a household name is Thomas Edison.
Yes.
And one wonders why it is that, for example, like people like Frank Crowe, who was so important for the building of the Hoover Dam, or this man Insull, that was a protege of Edison's and had a lot to do with electrification, or the man who spent a couple of years, Otmar Ammann, who spent 2 years designing what would become the George Washington Bridge, and he did it without pay. You know, all these people are fascinating stories, and we really don't know about them. We don't hear about them. Edison is the one guy, maybe because Edison was a great self promoter. He's the only guy that is still of these people a household name.
That's right. I think that engineers tend not to tell their own stories very well. They're not word people. They're numbers people and people who work with physical reality. They understand the physics and the math, and they don't do such a great job of, as you say, promoting themselves or of writing about what they do. We were talking about Frank Crowe, the chief engineer of Hoover Dam, he was asked one time to submit an autobiographical statement of 1,000 words, and what he turned in was 40 words long. And that sort of self-deprecation is pretty typical, I think. Also, I think that people who write write the story of their times tend to be intimidated by engineers and by engineering. I certainly feel that way myself. The science of what they do is difficult, hard to understand, and hard to really render in words. So there have been only a few great writers who have really done a great job. David McCullough is one of them, books about the Panama Canal and the Brooklyn Bridge. Gay Talese is another who has written about technology, but that tends to be fairly rare.
Well, I wanted to spend a little time talking about one of the other things in the book, and I thought maybe something else that's when you think about big things like the Hoover Dam, that's pretty obvious. It's an enormous thing. You can just stand there and you can look at it and be kind of dumbfounded. The other thing I thought maybe we might talk a little bit about is the Big Dig.
Yeah.
And here again is a massive engineering project, and here it's complicated by the fact that, you know, at least at the Hoover Dam, there was nobody living there. You didn't have to worry about working around the people who were there. Here you're talking about an enormous project to deal with the traffic flow in a major city and having to work with the fact that there are people living there that you want to be careful about displacing. And also, sort of on top of that, what they decided was they were going to do this massive project and they didn't want to interrupt traffic flow while they were doing it.
Right. Yeah, you talked about the sort of the great act of imagination that it takes to imagine Hoover Dam in the middle of Black Canyon, but it's equally great to imagine the biggest highway project in American history being built totally in the middle of a functioning large city, without causing a minimum of disruption. I'm sure Bostonians would say that the disruption has been considerable, but it's really minimal compared to what might have been without the tremendous efforts to keep things moving in that city that has been part of the Big Dig from the beginning. They had to move old utility lines. They had to keep this enormous flow of traffic moving through the city while they built these gigantic highway tunnels right underneath. It really is just an astonishing job. And to have made this commitment to not move a single residence, to me, is just extraordinary. And it says something about why we should continue to have faith in engineers and technology to do amazing things in this century as well as in the past. This is really quite an extraordinary achievement.
Yeah. And this project is ongoing.
Yes, it is. It's not finished yet. It has 3 or 4 more years to go.
Hmm. So the background to this, I guess, is you have to go back to think a little bit about the project that was undertaken in the 1950s during the Eisenhower years to construct the highway system,
the interstate.
Interstate mm-hmm. highway system. And so their part of this was putting in roads where there were no roads and essentially there was nothing. But also what happened is in big cities, they put in roads. And in a lot of places, we've come to know that there are these big beltway roads that run around and sometimes through the cities. And one of the things that had to happen, of course, for those things to go in is that people were living on those places.
Right.
A lot of people were cleared out.
That's right. This is not a great chapter in the history of American technology, the way that interstates were shoved through the big cities and a lot of neighborhoods were destroyed and a lot of people weren't treated well in that process. I grew up in Detroit and can remember the last of the interstates being built through there. And it's been an enormously disruptive process in many cities. And in Boston, Boston was one of the worst cases of this. Not only were people thrown out of their homes, but important historic areas were destroyed. And so a lot of people in the 50s and 60s, when the government was planning to do an even more massive beltway inside the city, got up in arms about this and went about sort of this grassroots protest movement and brought it to a stop in the 60s. But then the question was, what were they going to do next?
Mm-hmm. Part of it involved this enormous there. I'm not sure how many lanes there are. Maybe six or eight lanes, and as part of the central artery.
Yeah, right. Big overhead elevated. I'm just looking at a picture of it here. It's roughly six lanes plus all the exit and entrance ramps. Mm-hmm. It's an enormous structure that went right through the heart of downtown.
And took a lot of land had to be cleared. That is, places where people were living had to be cleared away. They got this horribly unattractive elevated roadway. And so at the point where they decided that it was that they didn't want to keep on like that, then they said, well, somebody said, well, why don't we take it and essentially bury it? That is, put it underground.
Right.
But then, just to make it that much more interesting, they said, well, when we want to do it in a way that it's not going to interrupt the traffic flow. So while we're building the underground thing, people are still going to be driving on the central artery. And then when the underground part is done, then we can take away the part off the top.
That's right. It's like a magician pulling a tablecloth out from under, you know, an enormously extensive set of dishware and crystal. That's about what it amounted to. And yet they really had no choice. If they were going to replace this artery, they either had to, I mean, it would have been more disruptive to tear it down to begin with and then rebuild it. This is really the heart of transportation along the whole eastern seaboard. You couldn't just stop it. So this quite ingenious plan to build underneath it while traffic was still moving up above was adopted.
Hmm. Was this, I asked this question knowing the answer, this was politically contentious, very politically contentious in Massachusetts.
Yes, it was, and for many years, too.
What really were the issues? Was it simply about the money?
It was partly about the money. There's an awful lot of complex financial politics that goes into the funding of the interstates, and Boston was trying to qualify for federal interstate financing, and had to fight a battle against the Reagan administration, which saw this as an enormous pork barrel project, and was not only so in that sense, it's not just about the money, but it was also about Ronald Reagan versus Tip O'Neill, then the Speaker of the House, the most prominent politician in the Democratic Party and in the state of Massachusetts. This was seen as his project. Also, the governor of Massachusetts at the time was Michael Dukakis. He and his Secretary of Transportation, Fred Salvucci, who was sort of the hero of this story, had been involved in this anti-highway movement in the 1960s and had pushed for mass transit and to qualify the state for interstate funding to build mass transit projects. So they were really seen as enemies of sort of the federal highway power structure. And here they came asking for the biggest interstate project in history. So it was just enormously contentious, and the funding was delayed for years. That's one of the reasons that the project became a lot more expensive than it was originally projected to be, is just because of the delay.
And what, today, what do they think the total bottom line is going to be on this?
$14 billion.
$14 billion.
Yeah.
Here, this is another case where, as we've discussed earlier, individuals really made a big difference. And in this, it seems like the one, perhaps one person more than any other. Of course, there were several governors who were involved in this, one of them being Mr. Dukakis. But perhaps the one person that more than any other that really contributed to this, made this thing go, was this man, Fred Salvucci.
Yes. A really interesting character. He, grown up in Boston, from a longtime Boston Italian family on both sides, all of his father, his uncles, his cousins, everybody worked in construction. His dad was a masonry contractor, really had the family had an enormous sense of investment and loyalty to the big public works projects in the city. Salvucci went to MIT, became a civil engineer, graduated in the early 60s, and went to work in the city as a highway planner. But his own family, his grandmother, had been thrown out of her house by the extension of the Massachusetts Turnpike in this big interstate project, building project that we were talking about in the 50s. And so he had sort of made a vow to himself that if he did get into highway work, he wasn't going to treat people this way. And so he becomes involved in this anti-highway movement, becomes involved in Democratic politics and eventually gets hooked up with Michael Dukakis as he's rising to toward the governorship in Massachusetts. Salvucci becomes Dukakis' Secretary of Transportation and is the one who masterminds this whole redoing of the city's infrastructure in the 70s and the 80s. He was the one who had the engineering vision, but he was also very much the political mastermind of this thing, right from the grassroots, going out, having coffee with neighbors in various Boston neighborhoods, helping them to understand what this project was going to mean, building this political consensus, not only among average folks, but among corporate executives, and then gradually selling it to politicians, and then eventually having to sell it to the highway types in Washington. So this is a case of a public servant. You know, public servants get such a bad name these days. This is a guy who just worked this project from the very beginning on a civil servant salary, and just brought this to pass. I think everybody in Boston would agree that without this single individual, this thing never would have happened.
Right. There are many, many phases of this, many aspects of this. One that we talked a little bit about, there was what they called the depression of the central artery, that is, getting it, lowering it down below ground.
Right.
There's also a remarkable bridge over the Charles, and I've never seen anything like it. I'm not sure that anybody has. Is it possible to describe a little bit what this bridge looks like?
It is spectacular. There are just a few of these in the world. They are becoming increasingly popular as new places, not just in the U.S. but around the world, make plans for new bridges. If you imagine a suspension bridge with the cables extending not downward from the big swooping hanging cables, but extending in sort of a V pattern directly from the towers. I can't do it justice with just spoken words, but there are pictures of this around of the Cable State Bridge over the Charles River, and it looks like a sculpture, and yet not an obtrusive one, not a sort of overbearing one, and not even somehow sort of obnoxiously modernistic. It's just this beautiful, simple structure, and that has really become sort of the signature of this project. Most of the project is underground, these enormous tunnels, and this is the one thing that is up above ground, and that I think finally people in Boston, it's now almost done, are seeing it and saying, my gosh, this is really a spectacular thing that we're doing here.
Yeah, people can think about it this way: is it the most when you think about a suspension bridge, you have the roadway, and then spaced along the run of the roadway, you have towers on either side of the roadway, and then the cables, in a sense, run down the sides of the roadway. And here the towers are inverted Ys, and they straddle the roadway that way, and the cables come down and support the roadway
way. So you're doing a better job than I am.
The book. I have the book in front of me, so I'm looking at the picture. So at least that helps. And yet, if you've not seen it, or if you've not seen one like this, I think it's still kind of hard to imagine what it is, what it looks like.
Yeah.
But it's very, very dramatic. It's a stunning thing. We have about 4 or 5 minutes left. We have a caller here. If I want to make sure I get this person in. The caller's in Urbana. It's line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
We just finished a vacation in New England and Boston, and our guides and taxi drivers had quite a number of comments on the Big Dig project.
They hate it, right?
It's driving the taxi drivers insane because they change the temporary routes every other day.
Yeah.
But the comment on the bridge you were talking about was that... some feel that it won't support the weight of the roadway for which it was designed. Have you heard that coming through on?
I have not. I've read the news reports about it fairly thoroughly, and it may be that complaint has been aired. But I I haven't heard any engineers make.
I made that comment to us. So
yeah. Who knows?
Yeah, and. I think there's a similar bridge across the Mississippi at Alton.
Yes, that's correct.
And
tell us your impression of seeing the bridge.
Oh, I think it's a great structure, and if you think of the masts and lines of old ships, you know,
yeah,
grown to gigantic size.
That's a nice analogy. Yes,
and it will fit in, I think, to the Boston area pretty well.
Right.
But I just hope they got it right.
Well, they've got the best engineering firms in the world working on this thing, and
yeah.
not that great engineers haven't made mistakes.
No kidding.
But I hope it's going to be okay.
The PBS TV series Cadillac Desert.
Right.
And it seems like engineering projects are great, but in many cases, the sociological effects of those great projects are many times not taken into account. So
that has been true in times in the past. That's right.
Yep.
On the other hand, that book, particularly a Cadillac Desert, although it's a good book, perhaps skews its analysis a little too far in the negative direction and doesn't take account of some of the really wonderful achievements that have been achieved out in the West as a result of these dam buildings.
Getting around it, it was not unbiased.
Right. It's really got a point of view.
Well, thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. Well, we are just about at the point I think we're going to have to wrap up, and there's much, much more that we could have talked about. So for people who are interested, you can definitely look for the book that we've talked about. It's titled Great Projects, published by the Free Press. It has a lot of really fine photographs and text by our guest. And sometime next year, you can look for the PBS series, a four-part series. This is the companion book to the series. The series also will be called Great Projects. That will be airing on many public television stations next year. And we want to say, Mr. Tobin, to you, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Oh, thanks very much for having me, David.
We appreciate it. And also, you might go out and look for Jim Tobin's book, which is his other book, Ernie Pyle's War, about the American war correspondent, the book that got a lot of very positive attention, including the National Book Critics Circle Award in Biography, 1998.